Accession number 27814, Mr. David Buck, Reel 11. Now, we're talking about the tours you did, and there's two. There's the Duke of Edinburgh's tour, that was a world tour.
Yeah.
There's some little ones that don't stick in your memories, and then there's the Canadian tour.
Yeah, yeah, the little ones were things like taking Queen Mother to Belfast, for instance. I mean, she loved Ireland, and she loved the yacht, and if she had the opportunity to go somewhere, then she would. We went to Holland with the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh and the children, I think. That was rather eventful, I guess. It was Queen Juliana. Most of these places you go to, of course, they have a banquet on board at some stage, and they're entertained ashore, and then the Queen always entertains on board as well at some stage, and the Duke. But this trip to Amsterdam and Rotterdam we did. In Amsterdam, we put on a firework display on the last night. Unfortunately, it went vastly wrong. And we left two fellows behind in hospital.
What went wrong? What happened?
Well, they were controlling the fireworks from up on the bridge. And somehow the fireworks to one side caught fire, and some of them exploded. They weren't seriously injured, but they had burns, and we had to leave them behind when we sailed. But it was small trips like that to the various little places, there was sort of intermittent between other visits. Sometimes we went places with nobody on board and just sort of showing the flag, this type of thing. Obviously we went to Cowes, and Cowes Week is one of Duke of Edinburgh's favourite weeks, and because he's a yachtsman anyway, so he always went to Cowes every year.
What was it like when you went to Cowes?
Well, from our point of view it was fairly quiet, because we had a couple of escort destroyers or frigates there, as always with the yacht. She never goes anywhere without an escort, at least one warship. So apart from the odd signal between us, there was very little happening on that side of it. Again, it was a pleasure trip for the Duke. I don't think the Queen was on board for that Cowes Week.
Now, what type of signal duties would you have? Generally, was there much signalling?
Not always, no, because, as I say, we were only in company with one or two ships a lot of the time. We did get involved in a couple of convoy exercises, and I think that was just for the benefit of, I think the Duke was on board on one occasion, but I think it's mainly so that they remember that the yacht is capable of being converted into a hospital ship if necessary, and may have to be involved in convoy work at some stage. So we did that, but generally we were only in company with one or two escort ships. Occasionally we met far more, like being welcome if you go to Canada, for instance. There was always quite a lot of warships came out as part of the welcoming committee, this type of thing. But yeah, the signalling was average. It wasn't very busy most of the time. There were far more signals in the way of wireless, I guess, radio signals, but of course we had to type all them out, etc. One of the onerous duties from our point of view was that every night we used to receive the BBC 9 o'clock news bulletin by facsimile, and we had facsimile in those days, a massive massive great machine that made horrible noise, and the actual reproduction wasn't that clever, but that was sent to the yacht in the middle of the night, every night without fail. The duty signalman had to type it out, the whole of the 9 o'clock news. Type it out, ready for the Queen to read at breakfast. And of course, the only way you could type it in those days to be able to copy it was on this blue paper, that actually sort of a carbon impression. So if you made a mistake, it was a razor blade and you cut the word out and you stick another one in, you could not correct it at all. So one typing error and you had to cut the whole word out and type it in another bit of paper and stick it in. Yeah, so you know, it was a pretty onerous task, and you know, when you listen to the 9 o'clock news, you don't really realise how many words there are in it. So it was quite a lengthy job to type it, and so it was imperative that it was on the Queen's breakfast table every morning. So that was a job that, you know, you always ended up with at night. But you were only, normally there was only one signalman on duty at night in the main signal office. Obviously, if you were at sea, then there'd be somebody else up on the flag deck or on the bridge. But yeah, I mean, probably a lot of our work was signal office work, and in facsimile, as I say, it was there, the typing side of it, radio communication on the voice side. The actual visual signalling part of it was only, again, with orders between ships, or general chat, maybe sending across changes to itinerary and the like, if you're actually in company with a warship. The skipper of the yacht would have to give them their instructions of what he wanted them to do when you're approaching harbour or whatever. But it varied, yeah. Sometimes it was quite busy, other times fairly quiet, depending on what we're doing.
And what about the trip to Canada? That was a 3-month trip. Now, is that with the whole? That's with the Queen, yes. Was the whole royal family or just the Queen?
That was the Queen, and it was the whole royal family. Yeah, that was a fantastic trip, really. As I say, the Queen flew across because she didn't fancy. Well, I mean, partly it's time, and partly that she wouldn't envy anybody going across the Atlantic in a ship of our size. I mean, the Royal Yacht isn't particularly large. She does have stabilisers, but they were antiquated, and if it was too rough, they had to take them in because they would buckle, and they would never get them in. So, you know, if it was really rough. And she literally rolled. I mean, you could see her going just like this all the time, because it was really a fairly shallow keel she had. So not a good seaworthy ship, really, from that point of view. But so Queen flew across, and we met her in Halifax, I think it was, or St John's, Nova Scotia, and carried on from there. And the idea of the trip was to open the whole of the St Lawrence Seaway, which had just been completed, and we traversed the seaway right from the mouth all the way down to Chicago, stopping at various areas on various ports, or not necessarily ports, but towns on the way down through the river, anywhere that we could moor safely, with plenty of room. But it's a massive seaway. I mean, the size of the locks are fantastic, and the rise and fall of the locks is amazing. You would actually be looking right down here, you know, you just go to the top lock and you'd be looking sort of hundreds of feet down where you actually ended up in the, you know, after about 4 or 5 locks. So we had the children on board, and they would go ashore. They would all go ashore virtually everywhere we stopped. The reception that the Queen received was absolutely massive. It's unbelievable what people will do. I mean, they used to actually rig scaffolding, seating on scaffolding on the quays, etc. And people would sit there all night knowing that the Queen was going to come off the ship sometime first thing in the morning, and they would sit there all night waiting for her. And the reception for her and for us, it was just the same for us. We used to go, if we went ashore, there would be people waiting at the bottom of the gangway, would you like to come to our house for a meal and this type of thing, you know. It was amazing. The children were, I forget their ages, 59, they were about 7 and 9, something like that, 7 and 10. Fairly small, anyway.
So that'll be Anne and Charles.
Anne and Charles, yeah. They were nice kids. Well, appeared to be nice kids. And you could speak to them, and they would speak. They would speak to you. They were very quite prim and proper, they thoroughly enjoyed themselves on board. There was always somebody detailed off from the ship's company to look after them. Normally senior rate seaman or a leading seaman or a marine, just to keep an eye on them when they were on the upper deck. But they used to play all sorts of games, sports and things. I remember one particular occasion when we were up on, we were anchored off somewhere, I forget where it was now, and they were playing cricket on deck, and there was a midshipman up there supervising them. He was told to supervise them, and the last thing that I think it was the commander said to him was, keep an eye on them, but do not draw attention to the ship for any reason. And the only escort we had there was an RAF patrol boat, way out, circling the yacht. I think the naval escort was around. I think they were probably actually in harbour there. They could go in. But Charles hit the ball over the side. So, of course, what did the midshipman do? But he called in this RAF patrol boat to come and pick up the ball. And what happened? Press boats, woof, you know. And Charles just looked at this midshipman. He said, I thought the last thing he was told was do not draw attention to the yacht. And because the midshipman went absolutely scarlet, you know, apologised and everything else. But it was too late, you know, he'd done it. It was the way Charles said it. It was quite interesting. But it was a fantastic trip. And for me, there was even more to it because I have an auntie not in Canada. And I'd spoken to her before we left the UK, and she said, what's the chances of you coming to see us, or can we come to see you? I said, well, you can certainly come to see us. I said, you won't be allowed on board, or you might be allowed on board depending on where the Queen is at the time, and where you actually meet us. But I said, chances of me coming to see you, I don't know. But I've put in a request if I could have a week's leave, and it was granted, and I left. They came to pick me up, my aunt and her friend and husband. My aunt's single, she's still alive now, and they came to pick me up at Kingston, and they were allowed on board, not around the Royal Quarters, because she was in residence, but they were allowed on board just to have a look around the upper deck. There's a photo there of them coming off. And they drove me to, she lived in Gault, fairly near Toronto, in Ontario. And I spent a week with her, travelling around various places, Niagara Falls, etc. And then she drove me back, and I picked up the yacht again about two or three stops down the river. Yeah, exactly where it was, they took me back to now. So that was something different, and I was quite pleased that I was allowed to do that. And as I say, they were very encompassing in that way. If people did have relations somewhere, they would let them get off and go and see them.
Now, there was one embarrassing incident that you've got notes about. Vice Admiral Dorney had a bit of a mistake.
The anchor.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose it wasn't really his mistake. But,
his responsibility.
His responsibility. As on any ship, it ends up with the commanding officer. But, we anchored in the lake. And I think, I forget why we anchored in the lake. We were nowhere near the actual land, as far as I can recall. I think we were probably going salmon fishing or something. That was one of the Duke's hobbies as well. And he let go of the anchor, and somebody, obviously a seaman, had not shackled the anchor in the cable locker. It may well have been the first time the anchor was used, because normally we went alongside everywhere, and particularly going down the river, of course, we didn't need to anchor anywhere. So it may have been the first time the anchor was used after we'd left Portsmouth. But the whole lot just shot out and disappeared at the bottom of the lake. Absolutely nothing we could do about it at all. Just signal was sent off to the Canadian Navy, and obviously copied to Admiralty and all in sundry, saying that this had happened, and could the Canadian Navy supply us with a temporary anchor when we got into port and recover the original anchor at some stage later, which has all happened. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Sure, exactly what the outcome of it was with the individual who was in there, because there's always somebody in the cable locker to make sure it doesn't get snagged. But if it was the case that it was the first time the anchor was used, then it really wouldn't have been his fault, because he probably wouldn't have been able to see the tail of the anchor and it shackled on to the deck. It would have been covered. So, certainly nobody was blown off the yacht for it, that's for sure. Where the blame was put in the end, I don't know. But it was embarrassing from the point of view of Dornay, because he had to tell all his sundry what had happened. Because we couldn't afford not to have two anchors. We've got 3,000 odd miles to go back to the UK. We may only need to just stop off anywhere on Ireland or whatever, and going back and anchor, and if you lost another one, then we'd be in real trouble. So, yeah, that was just one of those instances. Yeah.
Anything else about the Canadian trip? That's all I've got in your notes.
Yeah, one thing that did happen when we arrived in Canada, that we had lone crew members from the Canadian Navy, or should I say, from the two Canadian Navies. They have an East Coast Navy and a West Coast Navy. Never meet, because such a vast distance to get around one side to the other. I don't think they ever even exercise together, or if they do, it's a very rare occasion. And basically, they don't really talk to each other either, and they don't seem didn't seem all that friendly. They sort of piled up, I think, but initially they didn't really speak to each other very much. We had one of each on the signal deck, on the signal mess. One East Coast, one West Coast. I must admit, the West Coast Navy fellow was a much nicer fellow than the other one. They were both okay, but he was a real friendly chap, more Western Canada, countrified, if you like, than the East Coast people. But we found that. I found that in Canada anyway, that's the way they are. They were on board on loan and just did duties exactly the same as we did. It was just to supplement the staff and sort of liaison, if you like, because they knew more about the way the Canadian Navy worked, etc., and because they were our escort over there once we got over there. That was different again. They left us before we sailed back to the UK. But you know, they used to come ashore with us, and you know, they had a very old time. Any place that I think I can say we were not welcome was Ottawa, parts of Ottawa, French Canada. Not all of it, but bits. Yeah, you could see that as soon as they saw the uniform, yeah, don't want to know you. You know, and we don't speak English, you know, this type of thing. Yeah, but that was just to say that the visit there, as far as we're concerned, it was immaterial. It was something we were warned that might happen. But the rest of Canada was fantastic. And Detroit, the only interesting part about Detroit was they would not, you were allowed to go ashore there just for a short period. You weren't there very long, I don't think. And they would not accept anybody that looked a bit young. Everybody was 20 plus because you had to be on the yacht. But if anybody looked a little bit younger, they would not serve you in a bar without your playbook, proof of age. And there was one fellow that went ashore without his playbook, which he shouldn't have done anyway, it was his own fault. He had to come all the way back to collect it. It was quite a way into town, I think. And the other American visit was Chicago. I didn't get ashore there, unfortunately. We were anchored off Chicago for just a day, I think, and I was duty that day and couldn't get ashore, so I didn't actually get there at all. But so that was the luck of the draw. If you only stopped anywhere for a short period, if you were on duty, that was it. You didn't get there. But yeah, I mean, that was... stopped, I think, to check the itinerary, but I think we stopped certain places on the way down and then certain places on the way back. And it's, I say it's a long trip and a long way down, but it was a fantastic visit and historical event for them, in particular for the Canadians. And that was a trade route now, which never existed before. You know, for fairly large ships to go through.
And that was the second of your big tours.
That was the second.
Any other tours or things you remember?
One annual trip, which again is the sad part about the loss of the yacht, is the royal family always went to the Western Isles of Scotland in the autumn. And again, it was somewhere completely out of the way. They just used to go ashore for picnics. Motorboat used to take them ashore, leave them. And as far as I know, nobody stayed with them at all. It was just the family. Some of the islands were virtually uninhabited anyway. It was the Western Isles. Or it was an uninhabited part of the island, even if it wasn't an uninhabited island. And that was a two-week trip, I think. And it was something that the Queen loved doing, or the whole family loved doing, and something presumably she can't do now, or if she does, I don't know how she'd go. So there's all these little bits that, you know, you look at now and you think, well, some idiot made the decision to get rid of the royal yacht, and they just did not realise the benefit it had to the royal family.
Now, it's meant to be a hospital ship as well. Was that a real secondary function or not?
Yes, it was. It was. It was a real secondary function. It could very easy. I mean, the main banqueting room would be the hospital surgery, if you like, and then all these other rooms would just be turned into the beds, kitted out with whatever beds, I guess, could be fitted in there.
Did you ever practice, you know, when the Queen, obviously when the royal family weren't aboard, did you ever practice sort of a conversion to a hospital ship or any?
Not to my knowledge, we didn't. It may have been that certain parts of the crew had to do that, but it wasn't, if they did, it wasn't really made known to the rest of the crew. I don't think they did. She was called out, I think, to Falklands.
But way later.
Yeah, much later. But yeah, I think the other thing that people don't realise is, you know, it's not just the Britannia, but the Queen's workload on a trip like that is absolutely fantastic. As I say, she gets up early in the morning. She has to read the BBC 9 o'clock bulletin. She has a breakfast, and she'll probably go ashore immediately after that to one function or another. And she'll be lucky if she's back on board by midnight a lot of days. Or she comes back on board and they have a banquet on board or some function on board during the day or whatever. And that was day after day after day. But the fact that, you know, she could relax in between time, I think, made all that difference. If we were actually traversing between one stop to another or one port to another, then that was her time, and she was, you know, she could do whatever she liked. So they did play deck tennis and the like up there, quite enjoyed themselves if they had the time. But yeah, I mean, people say it was a luxury in that, but it wasn't a luxury. It wasn't a luxury ship. The only luxury point of view was the fact that it was her ship, basically, and she could do what she liked and, you know, spend her time as she liked when she was on there. And it's really sad to see that she's lost it. And I'm sure she was not too happy about it. Yeah.
Now, what about you? You had a 2-year term. Did you apply to stay on or to become a permanent? Was that possible?
It really wasn't possible. The one-third permanent crew, unless you knew that somebody was coming off or was actually told you they were going to come off at the end of the trip or the end of the 2-year period, whatever, there was no point in applying. Because you couldn't go back, to my knowledge, you couldn't go back a later date to permanent crew. If vacancies came up with permanent crew, then the existing temporary crew would fill them or one of those, because they would always be on the spot and know about it first, so they would get in first. So that there was no chance at all. The oldest fella on there, well, certainly in the communications side, I mean, he was a 3-badge signalman. He never went any higher than signalman. And he was in his probably late 30s, still had a couple of years to do. So he would have been the first one off, in 2 or 3 years' time after I'd left. So, you know, it was really no point in applying to go permanent crew, because there was...
Would you have wanted to?
Oh, yes, I think I would have done. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I certainly enjoyed it on there.
You didn't mind seeing out your service, with it?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, I would have done. There's a lot of pomp and circumstances on occasions. I mean, this, I mentioned before about changing dress. On one part of the Duke of Edinburgh's world tour, we were doing the Pacific Islands, and we called at 7 islands in one day, so we changed rigs 7 times in one day. We crossed the equator 5 times in the same day, you know, this type of thing. But because they were islands, it was still fairly informal. You did have to, I mean, they were inhabited islands on the larger side of it, so you did have to change rig each time. But yeah, I mean, those things, they sort of say, you could do without this, you know. I come to the end of the day, God, thank God that's over. But yeah, I mean,
that wasn't very often. That was a one-off.
That wasn't very often, no. I mean, the fact that you the discipline was had to be strict, but it wasn't over the top, because it didn't need to be. So there was nobody on board under 20. You weren't allowed to go on board under 20, and you followed the routine, the procedures, as you knew you had to do it, and that was it. There was one little bit that was